Let me take it back a step. Who am I? Let me stick with the question, who do I say that I am? Because I was convinced as a kid that I remember getting glasses when I was a kid. And I remember thinking, literally, this sounds so silly right now.
But I remember, probably had the experience.
I literally remember thinking, well, okay, good. That'll cover some of the ugly.
Wow.
I remember really literally believing that. So who am I was never going to turn out well. Who do I say I am had a chance.
After that clip, you know the rest is going to be good. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it.
Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community.
Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you're here. Today's conversation is with Mike Hilson. Mike is the senior pastor of New Life Church based in La Plata, Maryland. Since 1999, the church has grown under his leadership from a congregation of less than 100 into several churches and video venues. The New Life network of churches now averages more than 5,000 in regular attendance across Maryland, Northern Virginia, and online. Mike currently serves on the Board of Trustees at Southern Wesleyan University. He is also a member of the Chesapeake District Board of Administration for the Wesleyan Church. He lives in the D.C. metro area with his wife and boys. Mike has written several books, including Napkin Theology, Speak Life, A Significant Impact for Christ, Heart of a Leader, Moses, and a series of books called Coffee with a Pastor. These successes led to numerous invitations to teach and to coach leaders from multiple regions, states, denominations, and nations. Shout out to producer Ben Ford, you know, the guy who ensures all the sound is luxurious for this podcast. He was inspired by a current sermon series Mike is doing called Questions Jesus Asked and knew it would make for a good conversation. I'm grateful for the suggestion and connection. Mike, welcome to Curated Questions.
It's good to be here, Ken.
Thank you for saying yes. I always like to start at the same point and kind of get a little bit of backstory for folks. When did you first understand the power of questions?
Well, I think really for me, and understand the power of maybe this is not the right answer, but for me, quite frankly, questions became a major issue early on in life. More story than you need, but I grew up way out in the woods in North Carolina. Mm. Didn't have a lot of friends in junior high school. That's a story. That's a whole backstory thing.
Gotcha.
Here's the way I describe it. Junior high school is hell. High school is purgatory. Mm. College is okay, and life is good. So that's my view on the world. So during the hell period of my life, I would walk around. We had a lot of acres out there, and there was a creek, and I'd walk around, and I would spend hours just asking myself, the questions were just constant for me. Hmm. And then I also found myself in school, and I understood this at a fairly young age, somewhere around high school. I found that I was very bad at classes that were memory based, in the sense that just memorize this chart and you'll pass the test, or just memorize this formula and you'll be fine. And I was not great at math. And part of the reason was my teachers would say, "No, this is it. You don't need to ask questions. Just do this formula." And I would go, "But why?"
Hmm.
Well, that's a deeper question. We don't have time to go into that. But why? And if you couldn't tell me, so I was great at English. And I was great at philosophy because those wrestle with why.
Yeah.
I was terrible at classes where if you just memorized a rote set of data and reproduced it, it was fine because I constantly needed to know why. And so I began to realize these questions, it matters what questions I ask because that's going to get me the answer I need to even make it past a class.
Yeah.
And so college actually drove that down further for me. Why am I doing this? Why am I here? I don't mean why am I here existentially. I mean, why am I here? I started out as a music major. Why am I doing this? And then I started asking myself, what's this going to be like? And I was like, I don't want to wake up at 7 o'clock every morning to sit in front of a class of kids that don't want to be there.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, let's do something else. We did business. Hmm. And I ran back into a whole lot of these, remember these formulas and just follow these formulas. And I went, oh gosh. And so that wasn't it. And then I went into a studying for the ministry down at one of our church colleges, Southern Wesleyan University in South Carolina. And I was given the freedom there to not remember a rote set of theologies, but to study and to say, why am I a Wesleyan? Why do I believe this about the Bible versus that? And then if you're okay with me carrying this one step further,
yeah.
I became a pastor and they blocked me from taking this church of 120 because it was too big a church for me. I was too young for that. That upset me. I was going to make it through the interview process and they pulled me out because it's too big a church for you. But I looked around and my buddies who were Baptists were pastoring at my age churches of 500 people because everything in the South is a Baptist church. My Pentecostal buddies were already driving a Mercedes and here I am over here and they won't let me take a church of 120. And so I had to actually ask myself, why? For good reason, why am I a Wesleyan? Could I be a Baptist?
Mm.
And I had to unpack doctrinally and really unpack and go, nah, I can't do that. And then I had to, okay, could I be a Pentecostal? Because I have the energy to preach in a Pentecostal charismatic world. And I unpacked the theology and went, no. And I finally sat down in my office one day and went, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, I'm a Wesleyan. This is what I am.
Gotcha.
I'm a fourth generation Wesleyan as well, so I'm also born into it.
Right.
But my I'm a fourth generation firstborn son to be a pastor in the Wesleyan Church. So I was almost condemned to But by asking the right questions, I came down to the answer. This really is who I am. So questions have always played a major role all the way through. So I also had to ask the question, why is my dad not here? Because he left us when I was real young.
Huh.
So he was a pastor and left us when I was real young.
Gotcha.
So,
just think about the opportunity that you had growing up in taking those long walks. And I kind of yearn for that for the current generation or the folks that may not have that same expansive opportunity to encounter the world in such a way. Because I'm no doubt that the residue of that has got to be all over you. How you're living your life today.
I teach leaders every time I get the chance to talk to leaders. I will ask them and I will say, where is your creative boredom?
Mm, love that.
You've got to build space for creative boredom because if you're not bored enough, you won't think enough. If you're not bored enough, you won't listen for God's voice enough.
Mm.
If you're constantly on the move, you don't have time to think deeply or experience God deeply. So you've got to build in creative boredom. You got to figure out where that's going to be. That's something God taught me when I was 12, but it's played a huge role. You're not wrong. I wish kids had more time out of their house, walking up and down a creek, chasing crawdads and looking for snakes and all that. So I think that's huge.
I did have the experience of the creeks and collecting the tadpoles and very specific memory of a bunch of the tadpoles not making it in the big Tupperware bin that we had them in. Mm-hmm. But just being able to, as you say, kind of find that boredom.
Right.
And in that space, 'cause even now I struggle with scrolling through the social media to fill up the time. And it kind of get itchy where I'm like, well, wait a second, I'm not looking at something or I'm not embracing the boredom.
Right. And well, I've even gone so far as every house we've got, I always dig out a pond in the backyard just to put some goldfish in. Mm. Or, and I don't do it so much for the goldfish as much as the frogs. Mm. Because I now have 5 grandkids. 2 of my boys are married now, and they've got 5 grandkids. And I want them to go out there and look for the tadpoles and look for the frogs. And so I've got this little pond out there, and I'll have like 10 frogs take off jumping every time I go out there. And it, I will do that on purpose to try to keep the kids outside.
Mm. That's cool. So you're building some good memories for them as well. There's a bunch of other memories that I've got of or recent occurrences of just the intentionality of building in these memories, building in these opportunities that I could digress, but I'm not going to go that direction. So
that's a whole different podcast, but it would be a great podcast to have.
I've talked a little bit about and in a couple of previous episodes about some different things that have happened with my daughter. And so then her grandfather and memories that were made there. In doing some of the research on your story, you'd talked a bit about self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it could probably tie in well with some of this young boy roaming through the North Carolina woods. So how have you used questions in that journey of self-awareness?
My wife and I started dating when we were 16. Mm-hmm. So let's just start here. So we dated in high school off and on. We started dating steady, and we took off to Appalachian State University, which is where we started our college years. And I came to this moment in our freshman year that actually caused real stress in our relationship. And what happened that caused the stress was I asked a question to myself, which was, if I keep dating this girl, I'm going to marry her. And I had to stop and say to myself, am I okay with that? I'm okay with dating her. We're having a blast. I mean, we always enjoy doing the same things. To this day, we enjoy doing the same things. We've been married 37 years now.
Congratulations.
But I had to stop and ask myself, our sermon series is on questions Jesus asked. So one of the questions Jesus asked his disciples is, who do you say I am?
Mm-hmm.
So I literally had to stop in the midst of our relationship and say, who do I say she is? Because if I've up to this point said she's my girlfriend, that's one set of rules. But if I say she's my wife, that's a whole different thing. Because one thing I was not going to do, my dad left us when I was 18 months old, right? He decided he loved women and booze more than he liked God and my mom. And so he took off. He was a pastor and he took off. He did come back to the Lord later in life. Kind of a cool story. But I was not going to do that. I was not going to repeat that. I know I'm taking all the romance out of the whole thing, but I had to come to the answer, I say she's my wife. And that question, frankly, that question turned the direction of my life a great deal, because it was her that accepted a call to ministry before I did. And the summer we were supposed to get married, she said, I think God's called me to be a youth pastor. I said, well, you don't need to get that degree at Appalachian State University. You need to get that degree at Southern Wesleyan University, which is in South Carolina. So in the space of 2 months, we got rid of the apartment we had rented to live in when we got married, went on a honeymoon, did a youth camp, then did a choir tour with a youth choir, and then moved into an apartment in South Carolina and ultimately then into a house, found her a job down there and found me a job down there. And in 2 months, we transitioned states, got married, the whole everything changed. Everything changed. But because she went to Southern Wesleyan, I went to Southern Wesleyan. Gotcha. And but when I got to Southern Wesleyan, I had to wrestle harder with, who do I say I am? Am I Mike, the guy who's going to be a businessman, who's going to do this? Or am I Mike, the guy who's going to be a pastor? Am I Pastor Mike?
Yeah.
And that it was in that moment, tied all the way back to the decision that she is my wife. Now I'm in South Carolina wrestling with, who am I? And I'm Pastor Mike. And I remember a friend of mine saying, it was hilarious, Randy. I said, I think God might be calling me a ministry, Randy, but I don't know. How do I figure it out? He said, well, Mike, stop looking for a lightning bolt. Walk that direction. If it works, you'll know it. If it doesn't work, go do something else. You're young. And I went, okay, that makes sense. So I went into my first class, my first set of classes as a ministry major. Absolutely never looked back. because it put me right in that spot where I could wrestle with big life questions, and not just for me, but for everybody else. Hmm. How do I help other people deal with this? Not how do I tell other people what to think? Because that is not the role of a pastor. The role of a pastor is to help other people wrestle with the questions they have and wrestle with the life decisions they have in the presence of a God who is drawing them. Hmm. And so that actually, that was a beautiful spot for me. So I was very happy to be there. And but that, it all came out of those questions.
So that the self-awareness, you kind of really, first and foremost, look at that question and then this whole slew of events that happened in this short amount of time. Have you used them continually since then? Or was there another stretches or periods of time where you were like, okay, this is another growth season on this trajectory, or any other elements of kind of self-awareness, I guess, explore?
Kind of early on in ministry, the questions become more precise later on. Mm-hmm. Because John Maxwell explains it as this pyramid. And when you're at the lowest point of the pyramid, you have the most options. You do anything here. When you get higher up in the pyramid of leadership, you have fewer options.
Yeah.
You're higher in the pyramid. There's a lot of blessings up there. That's true. But there aren't a lot of options. So the questions become way more precise as I get older. But that one question, who do I say I am? Who does God say I am? Is the one that stayed with me from the moment I was there at the college. Then I was an assistant pastor, and I thought, well, I'm a music director, I'm a worship director, and I preach once in a while. Okay, I'm good. We loved it. Honestly, we loved being there. But we could have stayed there the rest of our lives, quite frankly, in that little church in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. But the pastor began to head a direction that we had to stop and say, we don't really agree with this. There's nothing wrong. He's not wrong. It's just not what we think ought to happen. And Tina and I sat down at a dinner one night and just said, can we do this? And the answer was no. Well, simply put, you either lead, follow, or get out of the way. I can't lead because I'm not the leader. He is. I can't follow because I don't agree.
Yeah.
So I only have one other option. So we resigned. And we resigned with nowhere to go. Okay, God. Who are we? You have to decide this. But then we went to a church in Hickory, and I could not, Ken. I wish I could tell you that it's just this natural innate ability to grow a church. No, it's not. Mm. I can pastor, and we're going to get to another question that explains how we went further.
Yeah,
I am a 150 guy. I can pastor 150 people.
Gotcha.
I know that because I worked for 6.5 years, worked my fingers to the bone in North Carolina, did everything I knew to do, and I got that thing up to 150, and that was it. And I remember walking around in the sanctuary one day, kind of angry with God, because I knew he had put in my mind and in my heart this much bigger thing, but it wasn't working. And I'm like, okay, well, what are you doing with me? And, you know, me and God.
Yeah.
You know, when you pastor a small church, there's a lot of hours when that church is empty and you can wander around the sanctuary. You know? And so it was empty. There was nobody else there. There's nothing going on. The worst moment in the world, I'm sorry, I digress slightly. Worst moment in the world for a pastor is when you take your first church as a solo pastor. You walk in the office, you preached your sermon on Sunday, you gave them the best one you had. You walk in on Monday. There's nothing on the shelf because you hadn't put your books there yet. There's nothing in the desk. And that phone does not ring. Nobody called. So I'm sitting behind this desk that looked a mile wide to me. And I literally sat down. I went, so what do I do?
What do I do now?
Anyway, right. Anyway, so I'm wrestling with God. And I'm like, you gave me all this big, huge idea, but it's not working. And I remember this wrestling match. I bet I was in there wrestling through this for an hour or two. And I remember, I'm sorry, I'm going to go a little bit
booga-booga on you here.
But I remember there came a point where the power of the Holy Spirit fell in that room to the point that I couldn't stand up anymore. And I just got down on my face. I literally, and this is going to sound weird to people, I'm sorry, but it's my lived experience. Yeah. And so I literally was flat on the floor, wishing I could sink into the concrete. That's what the presence of the Holy Spirit was to me in that moment. And I remember crying and saying, okay, God, I get it. if you ask me to pastor 12 people on the backside of a mountain in Tennessee for the rest of my life, that's more than I deserve. And I thank you. Literally within 2 months, I got the phone call to come with Maryland. So I had to come to the grips, who am I again? And in this case, who am I? I'm a servant of the Most High God. And whatever he does with me has to be okay. And at that point, opportunities broke open. That led to other questions. So I think God had to use the question, who am I, in the woods, walking down by the creek, and then coming to know Tina, to build up, who am I? And say, I am lovable. I can be loved. I can have people that care about me. I can trust her to stay with me. I think God used the question, the same question, who am I, in Hickory, to bring me down to where he needed me to be. Because there is nothing on the planet that would be worse than me living in the mountains, because I hate cold weather. And we were in the mountains at Appalachian State for 3 years. I knew what that was like. I was not going back to the mountains.
Not excited.
So when I say 12 people on the backside of a mountain in Tennessee, that's like worst case scenario for me. But even that is more than I deserve. And I had to come to that place before. I don't believe God would have let me go any further had I not come to that place. Who am I? Mm. I'm worthy to be loved because I'm a child of God. I ain't all that. Without the Holy Spirit,
yeah,
I've got nothing. These are the two realities I had to come to grips with. And all of that took, between those two moments, 10 years. That's just 10 years of wrestling with, who am I? Who am I going to be? And in the midst of that, I'm wrestling with, am I actually Wesleyan? And so all of that happened in that same space of time. And it all really boils down to, who am I? And I think for a young person, I think when you're just starting a career, when you're young, when you're just starting a family, when you're just starting a marriage, when you're just starting to be a parent, I think you've got to answer that question. Because let me give you a question I still to this day can't answer. I remember when our oldest son was born, Robert, and I held this little thing in my arms, you know. And we have three boys. Robert was born in South Carolina. Stephen and Joshua were born while we were in Hickory. And I can tell you, to this day, I don't know the answer to this. I do not know the answer to, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I don't want to corner anybody. This is not a gotcha question for anybody. Mm-hmm. But to this day, I don't understand how you could leave.
I'm sorry, how you could
leave? How you could leave.
Hmm.
I don't get it. I know that I'll never get it. In many ways, I thank God that I'll never get it, but I don't get it, you know? So my dad left us, and the only reason he had any relationship with us at all when we were kids is because my grandfather would come pick me up and take us to him. He never pursued us.
Yeah.
I can't even process that. And that's one of those questions that when it hit my mind, I fairly quickly went, I don't ever want to know the answer to that question. I don't want to know that, because if I know that, I'll know it because I did it. So I don't ever want to know that. So at any rate, that question hit me when I was younger.
Yeah, I love it. So I've been wrestling with a similar question, a lifelong question. My parents got a divorce when I was 9.
Mm-hmm.
I made a commitment, and as a 9-year-old, that I would never get a divorce,
mm-hmm,
because of the pain that I went through. So that commitment as an injured 9-year-old,
mm-hmm,
shaped how I was in my marriage.
100%.
And how I raised my kids, right? So now, for the record, my wife and I, we were married 32 years now. But it wasn't until, I think, about a year ago that I gave myself permission to get a divorce. Not that I'm choosing to go, mm-hmm, get one, but I know that that 9-year-old made a commitment out, mm-hmm, of pain. So earlier in our marriage, you know, when, you know, early
when
marriage,
still yelling
hard
at each other.
Yeah. And so it's like, well, maybe I just get a divorce. Anytime that would be thrown out,
that 9-year-old would rail, no, you will not.
Right.
It doesn't matter how bad it gets, how unhappy, how whatever, you will not get a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would change. I would now basically cower, right? Mm-hmm. Or
to the 9-year-old.
Yeah, you know, to my wife.
Oh, gotcha.
Or if there were things going on in the house where I should have done things differently, but I was concerned because I didn't want to make my wife unhappy. Why? Because then she might threaten a divorce. And now this 9-year-old gets commitment, mm-hmm. right? Gets thrust up, right? And that's also had all of these other downstream impacts. So there was an massive freedom
mm-hmm.
that came with me talking to the 9-year-old me and saying, the 54-year-old me at the time, we got this now.
Mm-hmm.
You're safe. And we got this. Okay. Not that we're going to pursue divorce, but I am no longer holding myself to that commitment.
See, and for me, same thing, except it played out on the parent side.
Yep.
My dad left. My stepdad was a great man.
Mm-hmm.
But you would not use the word warm and fuzzy at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, emotionally unavailable. It's the best way to say it. Great provider, yep. Great protector, all those things, but emotionally unavailable. So I had to ask the question when we started to have kids. And it was our first year of marriage. Robert was born 18 months after we got married.
Gotcha.
And we're students at college. We have no insurance. We're both in part-time jobs. And she comes to me. She's pregnant. And she's crying. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, God, she's going to hate this child. You know, we're struggling with this. But I had to unpack. I don't have a good father figure. And I had to build this regimen, sit down in my head and build this regimen of what am I going to be? What do I think a father ought to be? Because I know it's not either to any of the two I've experienced. I don't want to do that. I do want to be a good provider, good protector, but I don't want to be emotionally unavailable. And so in my case, that really played out to the point that we're probably too hard on our oldest. And probably got it about right by the third, you know, and but my oldest is great. They're all great, you know, but I had to unpack that. I spent a lot of years, and I mean, living it in live in the moment. What does a good father do right now? What does this look like?
Yeah.
I won't go into any details of any of the stories, but we had to unpack things. And, you know, how do you properly unpack things? I have one child that has chosen a lifestyle that's not in keeping with our theology or doctrine. There are different views within Christianity on how I should deal with that. I literally stopped and I went, okay, all of this is doctrine. And I set it over here. I went, I'm going to try not to cry. I want to be a dad. I don't care what the doctrine says.
Yeah.
I want to be a dad. And I literally looked at my wife and I looked at my board and I said, if you have to fire me, it's all good. Just let me know. I won't lose my son. And they were like, I'm sorry. They were like, we're good. Okay. I won't lose him. I love you as a church, but you weren't worth that.
Yeah.
And forgive me for being emotional today. I don't know why. But I had to ask the question, which was more, and that question, which matters more? And it's wrong, I guess, for a pastor to say, I took the doctrine and set it over there because I'm going to be a dad today. For a Christian pastor to do that, I suppose is wrong in some people's minds. But it's the only way I could deal with it because, and it gave me another one. Because what did Jesus die for? He did not die for me to defend my doctrine. Jesus did not die to defend my denomination. Jesus did not die to defend any of that. He died to forgive me and to show me grace. If I fail to show grace here, how is it that I'm being like Jesus?
Yeah.
So I'm going to put the doctrine over there. I'm still a follower of Jesus. I'm still a servant of the Most High God, but I'm not that. So I've got to be a dad today. How does a dad show grace? And I had to unpack all that. And to this day, I'm glad I did. Our kids are, anyway, it's worked out. So, I'm sorry.
I'm glad. No, just please don't apologize. Don't. Cause,
I don't know that you meant to have an emotional podcast.
No, this is what questions do.
They do.
Right?
They do.
They drive to, if you're using them well,
mm-hmm.
they will expose and bring out what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. They shape you.
Yeah. So that I'm only going to rejoice in it because, right. Yes.
So all of that is in the question, what is a good dad? And how do I live that out? And I wrestled with that for years because, again, I didn't have my best example of what a good dad is. It was my grandfather on my mom's side. And he was such a spiritual man. He was one of those guys, I'll make myself cry again. I'm trying not to. He was one of those guys that he would pray a blessing over the food when the family got together. And the Holy Spirit would fall like you were in some kind of revival service.
Wow.
I mean, I would not call him a great orator. He talked really slow. Now, Michael, when you get the best advice I ever got for a pastor. You ready? I've been to all of the leadership conferences. Yep. Everybody you can name as a leader, I've listened to them teach, okay? Best advice I've ever gotten from anybody for leadership in a church. Now, Michael, when you get up at that church, you just love those people and take care of them, and they will love and take care of you. Best advice I ever got. John Maxwell, great advice. You know, Rick Warren, great advice. All these people, great advice. That's the best I ever got. So,
and that's like meme worthy, right? I mean, you don't get the Southern drawl going in there and the speed and a meme because everybody will read it their own
so
base.
He talked so slow. But yes, he was the best example I had of what a father looked like. We'd go work out at his house, and he was already in his 70s by that point. We'd work at his house. And Michael, now let's just sit down and take a break here. And Mama, go grandma, Mama, go get us a Pepsi. And what was so funny is I know he never let my mom have Pepsi when they were growing up. So at any rate, that was my best example. So now I'm trying to be him because I have grandkids.
Nice. So, and giving them tadpoles and frogs and all that.
And Pepsis when their mom won't give them to them.
Yeah. So you've given two examples here of questions that you have carried with you for decades.
Yes.
Let's play around with those a second. And let's talk about what your practice has been in living with those questions for the long haul. Because the answer will change.
Right? Yes.
As you change, the circumstances change. But yet you keep coming back to who am I? And mm-hmm. that's been, and in your example that you brought out earlier, there was who are you in relation to your church, your mm-hmm. God, your family, right? But that's been a macro question, if you will. And then it's got all these sub-tier questions or children kind of questions. And it sounds like those have ebbed and flowed or changed over time, depending on mm-hmm. what the circumstances, but you've had an anchoring question of who am I that you experienced walking through the woods as a child and that. And then that question of how do I be a father?
Let me take it back a step. Who am I? Let me stick with the question, who do I say that I am? Because I was convinced as a kid that I remember getting glasses. When I was a kid, I got glasses. And I remember thinking, literally, mm-hmm. this sounds so silly right now.
But I remember, probably had the experience.
I literally remember thinking, well, okay, good. That'll cover some of the ugly.
Wow.
I remember really literally believing that. So who am I was never going to turn out well. Who do I say I am had a chance.
Powerful,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I need to stick with that question because then let me take a step further and let's move into something I won't cry about, which is let's see what this question does when your realities change.
because we did move to Maryland and the church did grow. And all of a sudden, we had this building that could seat 200 people, and we were having 450 people come to church. So we're holding two or three services. I got to expand the building. I got to do all this. And I'm getting tired. And my mentor, same guy that called me up, sends me, and I can't even remember the name of the teacher that was teaching it, sends me a cassette tape. Remember those?
Yeah.
And I'm listening to the cassette tape, and it asks this question. It asks this question. What can I not do?
Hmm.
It was an organizational question. Remember I told you I'm a 150 guy?
Yeah.
I can pastor 150 people. If you take my staff and their families that work alongside me closely, to this day, I pastor about 150 people. Because I don't pastor the 2,500 that come, or the, there's probably 7,000 people in Southern Maryland that call our church home, but none of them show up every week. A bunch of them don't show up every week.
Sure.
So we have a regular attendance in person of about 1,700 a week, another 500 online. And most of those are in Southern Maryland that they just watch online for whatever reason. I don't pastor all those people.
Right.
I pastor the people who pastor those people. That only happened because I answered this question. What can I not do? What's the list of things that are unique to me? And then whatever's not on that list, I need to hire somebody else to do it.
Mm.
That allowed me to layer ministry up. But I had to be honest about what can I not do, or else I would neglect. So for me, it came down to the word swim. I must speak. I'm pastor. I'm a preacher. I must speak. I must write. I write books, and I'm not sure anybody will ever read them, but I write books anyway. You know, I must invest in the next generation of leaders. I must invest in people. And I have to chair meetings. Speak, write, invest, meet. Swim. That's all I do. To this day, now this has been 10, 15 years now.
Yeah.
That's what I do. I do those four things. And everything else, somebody else does. Now, that doesn't mean I never preach a funeral. There are some funerals I do.
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't mean I never do baptism. Sometimes I do baptism. It doesn't mean I never do weddings. Sometimes I do weddings. But there's a reason. If they're going to put me in a funeral, or if they're going to put me up to baptize people, or if they're going to put me up to do a wedding, there's a reason. There's a layered out reason as to why I'm the one doing that, not somebody else that I need to empower to be pastor. One thing I had to unpack is, as the church gets larger, there's this massive group of people inside of my church that I'm not their pastor.
Yeah.
They listen to me speak on Sunday, but I'm not their pastor. Pastor Dave is their pastor because he did. Pastor Corey is their pastor because she did these things. Pastor Theo is their pastor because he did these things. Pastor Chris is their pastor. Pastor Aaron is their pastor. I had to unpack that. In some cases, people that aren't ordained. Chris Wagnon became their pastor, or somebody else became their pastor. Mark Rogers became their pastor. Who's going to become their pastor? I then need to build into, invest in, be part of, help train those people. Now, what that allowed me to do, that singular question, it was, I have to say, in terms of learning to grow a church and organize things, that singular question has been the most profound one I've dealt with, because it has to be a short list. Because there's not a lot of things that somebody else can't do.
Right.
Yeah. And then once you have the list, you got to live it out. And I've been able to hand things off to people along the way, because I understood this is not on my list of things I cannot not do.
How quickly did you embrace load shedding and being okay with that as a leader?
Okay, let's go back. Because I think leaders think where you come from determines how you're going to react when you get where you're going. So I'm struggling as a kid with who am I, or who do I say that I am? And there's a lot of insecurities that come out of where I came from. The Lord's helped me with a lot of them since then, but there's a lot of that. But I have spent most of my adult life, and, you know, Paul talks in the Bible about having a thorn in the flesh that God never takes away because it keeps him humble. And I think maybe this is one of those for me, because I'm the guy who wakes up every morning saying, today's the day I'll mess it up. So load shedding actually became easy for me. Because the more a church, and we're a volunteer organization, so the more a church grows, the more authority they press onto your desk because they trust you. If you're going to survive church growth as a pastor, you must push that authority back off your desk to somebody else because no one human can carry that much authority and either A, survive it because it'll wear you out, or B, have your moral core survive having that kind of authority, because authority corrupts and absolute authority corrupts absolutely. And listen, church people, bless their hearts, they will give you that. They will give you full moral authority, and you've got to push that away or else you'll get used to using it, and you can't do that. And so I quickly was able to do that. For instance, we plant churches. So let's say Ken comes to me and says, God's called me to plant a church in Southern Maryland. Okay, we're going to take you through the training. We're going to make sure you're really called, and make sure you're skilled, make sure you're equipped. And then what we're going to do is, Ken, come on. When are you going to plant the church? October. Okay, October. So in August, what we're going to do is you're going to come in. We're going to tag team preach a couple weeks. So I'll do one point, you do another, back and forth. And then I'm going to leave town for a couple weeks. You're going to preach. During the whole thing, I'm going to say to the church, if God has called you to go with Ken, go with Ken. Not only do you have the pastor's permission to go with Ken, you do not have the pastor's permission to stay here because you don't belong here anymore. You belong with him. And then your job is to take as many people out of my pond as you possibly can. Why am I okay with that? Because in the end, if the day ever comes that I mess it up, what I'm going to mess up is the one that I preach at. You're still going to be there. I just guarded. I just protected the movement from me.
Yeah.
Now, that is a horrible. There's a therapist watching this somewhere that wants to give me a session right now. I understand that's a horrible way to view that. But I think it's what God has given me to say, you need to remain humble and you need to understand. You may be Pastor Mike, this guy, but you're still Michael walking through the creek. And understanding that juxtaposition, I think, helped me push off authority and slough off authority to other people. It happened early on, and then it happened more as we planted churches. I lose church members to one of our church plants all the time, either because they got mad at me or I said something they didn't like, or sometimes they don't get mad at me. They're just like, you know, I think I'm going to go over there for a while. It's like, okay. Good friends, people I travel with, you know, will go to another church. I'm like, okay. That's the way it is. That's who I am now. But all of that came back to, what can I not do? I have to not do what's not mine to do.
You answered one of the things that was on my mind about any mentors that you saw or experienced that have done questions well. Are there any other examples or questions that you got from mentors that you found helpful that come to mind?
Same mentor, Dr. Wood, sent me to Rick Warren's Church Growth Conference in Southern California, in Orange County. And so we went down to Saddleback and we're listening to him teach. And I had asked myself, okay, we're able to bring people into the church now. How do I make sure we're taking care of them properly? How do I make sure we've got them in a process of development? And I was wrestling with, how does that happen? I mean, I kind of knew how that happened to me. I've often said I'm far less traditional in my idea of coaching and mentoring and far more rabbinical in the sense that if I'm going to coach you, it means we need to take a walk and you just need to come alongside me. We're just going to do this together. It's more rabbinical in that sense. It's not like the classical Greek way of doing things where you get in front of a class and you teach people. I do that, but to really mentor somebody's not there. It's walking together. It's having meals together. It's just doing things together. I had to ask myself, so how do I do this? Because I can't just walk with people, which was basically, if I take two steps forward, that's the birthplace of Coffee with the Pastor series. I can't sit down and have coffee with everybody in the church over the book of James. But I can write something that's going to go about 4 weeks and give you 5 readings a week. Each one is 300-400 words in it, so you're not going to have to read that long. And we'll unpack James together. And if you have questions, you can email me or you can come see me at church. But I don't have time to have coffee with everybody, so I'll write these books that do that. And so that was the birthplace of that. But at the Rick Warren conference, he gave me a structure. I altered it slightly, But I was asking the question, how do I take people on a proper progressive journey of growth? And he showed it where he did it in a baseball diamond. So I don't remember his words for each base. So I'll give you mine. The baseball diamond. So first base is invitation.
Okay.
I invite people to a relationship with Jesus. Second base is maturity. I got to teach them what they actually believe. That was the birthplace of the book Napkin Theology. I need a way to explain my basic theology to people. It's so simple that they could draw it on a napkin.
Yep.
So that's what we wrote. Pitching mound is praise. It's praising God as the center of everything we do, right? Third base is action. We got to put people to work, okay? Home plate is calling. The dugout, the manager's box, is trust. So what I was able to teach people was praise is the center of what we're doing. This all spells impact, by the way. Praise is the center of what we're doing, which is the source of that book, Significant Impact. But we invite people, watch, bring them in, put them to work, grow them up, send them out. You don't score till you send them out. Far too often, pastors count it as a score when they get on first base. No. Even deep churches count it as I've scored once I get them into a small group. That's second base. No, you haven't scored a point till you send them back out in ministry somewhere else. So that reset, because of the way Rick Warren explained it to me, and then I unpacked it based on who we were, that reset the way we do ministry. What's our win? Well, we're going to count attendance, and we're going to count all of our small groups, and we're going to count all of that. But the real win is when we send them back out either to be a pastor or send them out to plant another church. The win is over here. It's not where everybody else counts it, because what everybody else is counting is the size of their own kingdom. I'm sorry. That's way too harsh.
No,
I'm not bashing other pastors, but I don't want to count the size of my kingdom.
Yeah.
I want to count the size of God's.
That certainly takes the pressure off regarding your example earlier of folks, they're going to go to different churches. It's like, okay, cool. But whatever is the best thing, but it's the recognition that as you are encouraging and helping people build their life of faith, this is the end state goal where you're deployed in some capacity out there. So less about, as you say, building your kingdom.
Well, you know, look, I say this all the time, every church of size plants churches. Most of them just don't mean to. It happens because the church split. We build the split into our process and just say, let's just do it. Because can I tell you something? To have your skin torn by an accident is far more traumatic than to have a surgeon cut it with a scalpel. Therefore, we're going to make it surgical because the tearing is going to happen.
Having gone through some church splits, that when you're going to a surgeon, you can use anesthesia.
Yes.
So you can have a conversation and you can prepare people for pain.
Yes.
And that rending of relationships and how those are going to change, right? Instead of, instead of the tearing apart that happens.
Right. Let me take you to, because you went there. You just went to what is my, you said you want to get to what is your today question.
Yeah.
I'm 58 years old. In 2 weeks, I will be 59. I have a grand total of one more year in my 50s. And this question developed in my mind probably 10 years ago. And it has become a driving question. And I call it end game thinking. If I continue on the path I'm currently on, what is the logical outcome of what I am currently doing? And I have to tell you, I think far more human beings inside of culture need to ask this question because you can answer it. There are examples that will show you if I continue on this current path I'm on, what is the outcome I can expect? If I continue on the current path I'm on of just trying to grow one church, and when I started processing it, here's what I came down to. If I spend my entire life and I build one church of 5,000 people, what I'm going to leave behind is a high probability of failure
because that church tends to go down after the founding pastor dies or quits.
Yep.
Okay. But if I spend my entire life and I pastor one church of 1,500, but I plant 15 churches around me, what I'm going to leave behind is a high probability of success. This is very clear because we see this. Any one of those 15 churches that might be a church of 200 has the opportunity to become a new life and be a church of 1,500. Maybe five of them do that. So I started asking that question, what is endgame thinking? I have to ask that question in Southern Maryland because I'm going to be 59. So somewhere in your 60s, look, when I turn 60, you know this. It's not like I'm considering what's my next job. Nobody's going to hire me. You know. So the question is, what do I leave behind? I'll give you a real broad example. One of the major failings in not having endgame thinking is you can find in presidents of the United States. Almost none of them establish their successor before they leave. I'll give you one that'll make everybody happy. George W. Bush failed because he did not leave a logical successor behind him. Cheney was old, and he didn't raise anybody else up.
Right.
I think he had a successful presidency, but he did not leave a logical successor behind him. That's a failure. I think Obama did the same thing. He did not leave a logical successor behind him. And this is so common. Now, it's excusable because who knows when these guys have a chance to even think. You know, being president has got to be the worst job on the planet.
Not jealous.
You know, seriously. Not jealous. But you see that. But take it on a lower scale. If I don't set this up now, what's going to happen? So as I choose successor, there are more questions. My successor in Southern Maryland, in Charles County, Maryland, there are two options. My successor must either look a lot like me, i.e. be one of my children, or must look nothing like me because Southern Maryland is predominantly not Caucasian. So there are two options. Historically, I can see that there are churches in predominantly not Caucasian cultures that have a Caucasian pastor, but he's second or third generation from the founder and the child of. That works. And there are churches that are successfully transitioned from a Caucasian to a non-Caucasian if this is set up properly ahead of time. So God sent us the right person that is going to be the leader after I'm gone. His name is Theo Bolden. He's an African-American young man who's just now turned 30, I think. But God's just anointed this man to lead and to teach and to preach. And it's really amazing to watch him do this. And so we got in front of the church and we said, we don't know how long Elijah walked with Elisha before Elijah was taken up into heaven. But Elijah walked with Elisha until God said, you're done. I'm taking you home. So I'm here to tell you, we found Elisha. Don't know how long we're going to walk together. In my plan, I'll be 70. But we don't know what God's thinking, but I want you to know because I have to set this up. I have to do some in-game thinking so that there's not a vacuum when I'm gone. And I just think more people ought to do this. Let's go a different route. Communism. You want to be a communist? Let's do some in-game thinking. Walk your way through how that's played out.
Sure.
Yeah, no. You know, okay, totalitarianism. You want to have a king? Okay, let's walk our way through how that's played out. What is the logical outcome if I continue this direction? Is our capitalist system of representative government perfect? By no means.
Yep.
But let's walk it out.
I forget who said it, that our form of government is a particularly bad one,
except when you compare it to all the others. You know, I mean, I think that's probably true. Because let's look at how it plays out. You can do this in all kinds of ways. You can do this in all kinds of places. I remember talking to a businessman once, and I said to him, when you build a building for your company, how do you think through what that building is going to be worth in 30 years? And I'll never forget his answer because it crushed me. And I actually went back and processed it, said, I can't do it that way. He said, I don't think anything about that. Because in 30 years, it's not going to fit what I need anyway. So it's probably going to be torn down. And I thought, that is exactly how you need to think
to build a powerful business right now. So I'm not opposed to him. He's making the right choice for the industry he's in.
Yeah.
I pastor a church that will be standing there in some form in 150 years. Okay, now I can't think like that. I have to think like this.
Yeah.
And so I had to unpack that. Mm-hmm. I think far too many people have the shorter term in mind when I think in terms of ourselves, our family, our kids, we need the longer term in mind. We need some end game thinking. What are the natural outcomes if I continue exactly the way I'm going around? Finances. If I continue to only put $200 a month away for, and I'm 59, what's the outcome? It's not good. If I can start putting $200 a month away when I'm 20, the outcome's better.
Yeah.
End game thinking. But far too few people will bother with end game thinking. And I think in any area of life, if I continue to treat my kids the way I'm treating them right now, what's the natural outcome? If I continue to treat my wife the way I'm treating her right now, what's the long-term outcome? You can answer that question if you'll think about it. But you have to think about it. I read a book recently about longevity because I'm old now. And I need to think about that, right? I loved his questions. He said, do you want to be able to pick up your grandkids, in my case, your great-grandkids, when you're 80? Yeah. He said, then you need to be able to do a kettlebell squat with 25 pounds. Oh, well, I could do that. Wait. Between here and 80, you're going to lose half your strength just by natural causes. So that means now you need to be able to do some kettlebell squats with 50 to 70 pounds. Then you'll be able to pick up your... You want to travel when you're 80. Yeah. Then you need to be able to do a kettlebell swing with 25 pounds because you got to be able to put your luggage up above. So now I need to be able to do kettlebell swings with 50 to 70 pounds. I love those questions. Yeah, those are end game thinking questions.
Right.
So.
And I'm assuming this is Peter Attia's book.
Yes, it is. Yeah, you read it?
You've got to give proper attribution to one of my favorite people.
So, it's Peter Attia's book. Yeah. It was an excellent book. I loved it because I loved what he said. I'm not here to help you live forever. I'm here to help you live better.
Yeah.
Square the curve is the way he said it in the book. And I love that. Square the curve. I want to square the curve.
Yep. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier, a simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. There's two different areas that I want to touch on with you regarding the area of how should those of faith look at using questions in investigating their faith. Mm-hmm. So using questions intentionally and not fearing what you may find as you go through that. Because my background, certain questions were encouraged, but there was a whole realm of questions that were not necessarily encouraged because you might not have the tools to unearth or to deal with what you find through that investigation. So that's one piece. And then also then a follow-on question or something else that I want to definitely touch on is, what are you learning about questions going through this current sermon series that you're doing in that? So those are two primary things that I definitely want to touch on.
Would it be all right if I take the second one first? It'll be much easier to process because what we're learning about questions by people's response to our questions or asking questions in the sermon series is that people don't ask questions, they give opinions. Mm-hmm. They are throwing, I've read words on paper that I have not read on paper in a long, long time. Mm. So there are some people that are giving us very thoughtful questions, but I have to be honest with you and say they are in the minority. The majority of what we get is not questions, full on pejorative comment.
Wow.
And there's a lot of anger out there right now. And I think it's because people aren't asking questions. What happens if you silence half or a third of your nation and tell them they can't talk anymore? What happens then? Well, what happens is frustration and anger, but we haven't thought about that. We want to silence people because we don't like what they're saying. But if you silence the whole, you create frustration and anger amongst the people you silence, even if they're wrong.
Hmm.
If you silence them, you did not make it better. You made it worse because now not only are they frustrated, they're now victims. And victims are allowed to act out in ways that non-victims are not. And so you see the problem we're creating. So I think that's a real problem, is that people are not thinking. And when we give an answer that we can even anchor not just in spiritual subjective truth, I accept that culture sees our spiritual biblical truth as subjective. I accept that. I don't view it that way, but I accept that that culture does.
Okay.
But even when I answer in the objective, I can historically show you this, there's a complete dismissal of all that to stay right in the thought process they want to be in, because they don't ever want to leave that thought process, so they're not asking questions. They've come to determinations. And I think that's one of the greatest sins in society, and even within the church. We come to determinations. Every belief system you have, and there's a pastor that's going to be mad at me for saying this, but every belief system you have jumps somewhere off of a given base philosophy. So let me give you mine. My given base philosophy is there is a God, I'm not him, and the Holy Bible is the book that tells me about him. That's where I start. Everything else I decide is based on that. And these three things are philosophical choices. They just are. Now, yeah. I believe them to be objective theological truths. But I understand that in the overarching conversation with the world, these are given philosophical choices. If you understand that these are the three philosophical choices I'm jumping from, then you now can have a logical conversation with me, because I'm going to come from here.
Right.
You know, because these are my, there are other people that start from the philosophical position, there's not a God. Matter is all that has been there. And we were absolutely evolved from nothing into something. Now, they can't tell you how that happened, because whatever it is, it's supernatural. By that, I mean, it's beyond what we can see, touch, or measure. Big Bang Theory is supernatural because we cannot replicate it. We do not know what caused it. It's actually the exact same story that's in Genesis. It's just a bang rather than a God saying, let there be. These two stories are the same, quite frankly, but I digress. But so people are not asking questions. And I think that's part of the problem in our culture right now. People have come to conclusions. They're not asking questions. I think even theologically, people need to come to your conclusions, yes, but constantly be questioning your conclusions. I say it this way. When I was younger, when I was a young pastor, my greatest fear was being a liberal, because liberals rejected the Bible. I didn't want to reject the Bible. As I'm older, I don't want to reject the Bible, but my greatest fear is not becoming a liberal. My greatest fear is not showing enough grace, because Jesus didn't die on a cross for my doctrine. He died on a cross for my heart.
Yeah.
And I got to show grace. So I ask other questions, biblically speaking. I think you got to ask these questions. Jesus said, with the measure you use, it'll be measured to you. And he uses this in terms of judgment and in terms of blessing. So if I'm to believe my Bible, I have to ask myself the question, how generous am I being to other people? Because if I'm being generous to other people, God's going to be generous back to me. If I'm not, if I'm being judgmental, then I'm going to face judgment. I need to ask those kinds of questions. And I think that doctrinally, biblically, spiritually, we need to keep our eyes open. You will have these base philosophies you jump off of. There is a God. I left one out. He's good. I'm not him. And the Bible is my lens into who that God is. So this is my base philosophy I jump out of. And when I jump out of that, I now need to, here's my base philosophy. What must I now unpack and understand? Because the way you unpack scripture in 320 AD is not the same as the way you unpack scripture in 1200 AD, is not the same way you unpack scripture in 1950s, is not the same way you unpack scripture now. What has not changed? The truths of the scripture have not changed. Jesus, virgin birth, resurrection, crucifixion, all those things. The truth of scripture hasn't changed. How it applies to culture has, because how would a first century, can you imagine being John the Apostle on the Isle of Patmos and trying to describe modern warfare, which is probably what he was looking at when he was being given visions of end times, and trying to describe. Can you imagine someone from first century AD describing a stealth bomber? And for all we know, he was looking 500 years past us. We have no idea. You say, do you really believe that? Well, yeah, I believe there's God. The Bible is my book. Therefore, I believe there's a God that's over time and he knows what's coming and he could take us anywhere and show us anything. I do believe that. I do. You don't have to agree with me, but it is what I believe. And when I unpack that, I got to ask myself, what does that mean for my life? What does that mean in how I live? Again, back to the example of with the measure you use. If I have a life verse, that's probably it, because I make every decision. I make every decision in my life on that question. What measure did I just use? You know, what measure do I want God to use back to me? I make almost every decision in my life based on that criteria. And so, you know, what does it mean to love my child, even if my child's going to reject my faith? I got to ask that question. And I got to ask that question saying, I'm going to be a dad.
Yeah,
I'm also going to be a pastor. How do I balance these? And I think in the end, if we can just live in that end game thinking world, for instance, let's go back to the core question in my life. Who do I say I am? Okay, we've come a long way. I started with, I first found my niche when I found choir. I sang in high school and I became one of the choir and theater kids.
Gotcha.
That was my niche, yeah. Right? Then my niche became Tina's husband. Then my niche became, I'm a pastor. Then I'm a dad. Then I'm a pastor of a large church. Now I'm the mentor and the investor in a whole lot of staff people. Now, all of these things have, there's the denominational thing. There's the teaching we've taught around the world, frankly, at different places. Not huge. These are smaller events, but we've taught in a lot of places because yeah. We're Wesleyan. Our little tribe is everywhere. So we go everywhere. And so all of that's true, right? Now. I said earlier, so now my job is to be more like Grandpa Freeman. Because now I'm a grandpa. And my life is not going to wind down like we talked earlier about the Peter Attia book. I want to square the curve.
Right.
But what does that look like? Because I'm not going to keep doing what I do right now until I'm 90. That's a bad idea. I don't want to do that. That's the sadness of Brett Favre not quitting being a quarterback when he should have. Those last year or two was kind of sad. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And so
Don't do that.
So what am I going to do? So as God would have it, because we've asked the right questions and reacted to them, by we, I mean me and my wife, our kids are willing, and I'm going to have a meeting this week. We're going to buy a 30-acre piece of property. My son and I are going to build one house on it. It's going to have a space for me and Tina. It's going to have a space for him and his family. And we're going to run a little farm out back. Nowadays, the kids are calling it homesteading. We just called it, it's a farm out back. We got a garden and it's pretty big, you know, but we're going to do that now. And why? Because from that vantage point, I can invest in my grandkids consistently. You say, but you're going to move in with your son? Well, yeah, I like him. He seems to like me, you know. And then my other son, who's married, Joshua, the youngest, they're going to buy a lot right next to the 30-acre lot and build a house. Now I'll have all my grandkids right here. We got five now, one more on the way. So there'll be six grandkids. They all get to grow up together.
Right.
That's beautiful. Get to take them on walks in the creek that's down at the bottom of the hill on the property. I get to show them how to find a crawdad. I get to show them you can touch any snake in Southern Maryland, except if it's rust colored, don't touch it.
No.
So, all the rest of them are not going to hurt you. I get to show them all that. That's worth it. Who do I say I am? There's going to come a point where I am Pastor Mike, the guest speaker once in a while at New Life because he's the old dude and we let him drool. And who do I say I am? I'm Papa. That's who I am. And I can roll out the rest of my days being Papa. I'm still planning on being pastor for the next 11 years, but but we'll see what God does.
Yeah.
So
as you're describing your philosophical tenets, right, of your view, I don't know if everyone, certainly I can't list off my four, but I think that that's a super helpful exercise just so that one can understand what their framework for living in the world is.
Right.
So now as you engage with others, whether they align or not, at least you're like, look, these are the foundational components. Now we can have a conversation. We can share them.
Can I give you a devastating exercise that will help you find the four tenets?
Come on, bring it on.
Okay. It's devastating. You have a grandchild?
Yeah.
Okay. How many? One?
Four, and four. Actually a great grandchild.
No. I don't need all that detail. Name one that could crush your heart the fastest. You love them all. That's not what I'm saying.
Right.
But Nora's mine that could just, well, now it's probably Louisa, that can just crush my heart the fastest.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to say Lauren.
Okay. Lauren. Okay. I want you to do this. I want you to shut everything else out. Give yourself 2 hours.
Yep.
Okay. Sit down in front of a keyboard.
Yep.
And I want you to write your own eulogy for your funeral. Okay. But you're not giving it.
Lauren.
See, I can't even say it. Lauren's giving it. And if by the end of that, you're not snot crying, you didn't do it right.
Hmm.
Then get away from it. Get rid of the tears. Clear your head.
Yeah.
Go back and read it. And look for the themes.
Hmm.
You'll find the themes. When I tell you swim, that's my career.
Yeah.
I have 5 other words that come out of a eulogy that I wrote from Nora's perspective. Fun, safe, strong. And I can't remember the last two. I can't remember the last two, but I'll remember them later. But you see, this is what I want to be.
Yeah.
And then here's what I can do when I did that. This is what Mike, Papa Mike, Dad Mike, I want these to be what you know. In order for my world to work, my job to work, I need to do these four things. Because these four are born out of what can I not do. These 5 are born out of who do I say I am. I did this with a college president one time, and he was just devastated. He wrote it from his daughter's perspective. And he read it to me, and I had a whiteboard in front of us. And as he was reading, I would write down words. I would write down words, words that he repeated. And then we coalesced those words into 4 things. And I said, that's who you want to be in your life. He said, yeah, that's who I want to be in my life. Okay, if you're going to be the president of this college has got to fit inside that, or else you're going to hate your job.
Mm.
So how do you now do your job? What can I not do to fit inside of that? This is who I say I am. Now you've logically moved forward to say, I know what I'm intended to be. Now I can answer the question, how do I get there?
Hmm.
Good luck with that.
No.
It is a devastating exercise.
Yeah, so. Well, bring it on. I mean, because it's...
Write it from all your grandkids' perspective if you want. But
where I'm going with this is that I'm just very passionate about living a full life such mm-hmm. that really understanding the human experience and kind of being able to suck the marrow out of it.
Right.
And in being able to do that, that means engaging in exercises like that, right? Let's get in and find the meaning, right? Yeah. And really get to it. And you don't get that playing around safe on the edges.
No.
It's you got to dive in and go deep and really pull that stuff apart. So I think that's, challenge accepted. Yeah, no problem.
Much shallower question toward the same thing. When I was a kid, my mom and dad didn't go anywhere, but my aunt and uncle did. And they would drag me with them.
Hmm.
And we would go to all these places, do all these things. And I remember as a kid thinking, when I grow up, I want to be Jim and Diana. I want to be like them.
Yeah.
My Aunt Diana died 25 years ago, but I always kept that. So complete sidebar. I want to experience the world. I always say to people, they say, you got to quit burning the candle at both ends. Well, here's the problem. When I get to heaven, I don't want to have no candle left.
Mm.
You said, I want to get all the marrow, even the marrow out of life. That's a great way to say that. And so Tina and I have traveled. I've been on,
I've been on every continent except Antarctica, and I'm probably not going there. And we've traveled a lot, and we've seen places. We're going to do more of that. I'm planning to do more of that. Why? Because I do. I want to experience that. Now, that's the more shallow part of who do I say I am? I also say I'm a traveler. I like to do that. I want to experience the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I may not agree with them. I may not agree with theology. It doesn't matter. I still want to know what they're like because I found that humans are humans.
Yeah.
And what they want to do is they want to live, they want to love, they want to enjoy life. That's what they want to do. Okay. Let's see how other people do that.
We've covered a lot of ground and I'm grateful for that. Any other things about questions that we haven't touched on that in hindsight you'll go, ah, I should have mentioned that because we haven't touched on it.
Okay, you know I'm a pastor and you know I'm a Christian.
Bring it on.
So here we go. There is this grand question that keeps coming up, and it's not just in this sermon series. It's every time we have ever in my entire career opened up for questions, I always get the same question. And the question is, why would I believe in a God that you can't prove exists? My answer is always twofold. Number one, you can't prove he doesn't, so we're in the same boat. That's the first one, but that's dismissive, and I don't want to be dismissive. So the real answer is, let's play a philosophical game. Let's assume God is not. Let's assume I'm wrong. God is not. What have I missed in my life by following a biblical worldview and the biblical tenets of how I should live? Well, I've missed, this is going to sound offensive. I'm sorry. I've missed not engaging in all the sins that the Bible gives us. So I've missed addictions and I've missed divorces and I've missed affairs. I've missed murder. I've missed covetousness. I've missed stealing. I've missed experiencing those things. Mm. What have I gained? Well, I've gained living in a world in such a way that other people look at me and say, hey, that's a good person. You can trust him. I've gained being true to my wife. I've gained being true to my kids. I've gained being true to my marriage. I've gained being a person of integrity. I think when I'm done, if I die and it's just over, I'm okay with what I missed. Mm. Okay, let's flip the script. What if I'm right? Because you can't prove I'm not. You can no more objectively prove I'm wrong than I can objectively prove I'm right. So let's flip the script. What if I'm right? What have you missed? And I think, again, this comes back to that end game thinking question. Now, you still may have not had the affairs or stolen anything or done. You still may have not done any of that.
Right.
But if you have not accepted God and he is there, that's a big miss. And the only reason you would make that miss is because you're so convinced of your own conclusion that you're not willing to explore the possibilities. And we have a word for that. It's called arrogance. And you really need to unpack it. You know, maybe you unpack it and you stay right where you are. It's okay. But do the work of thinking your way through it. Because I'm telling you, it is far more logical to follow God than it is not to. So that's the question I would pose. What if you're wrong? What if I'm wrong? What do we lose? By the way, I love in the movie The Mummy. Have you ever watched the original with Brendan Fraser? In The Mummy, the mummy shows up on this guy that's been helping them.
Oh, okay.
And he starts pulling out all these emblems. See, you never notice the necklace until then. One is a cross. One is the crescent for the Muslim faith. And he's just going through all of them. It's like he's covering all his bases just in case. You know? I'm like, I don't think that's the right plan. But at least you understand what I'm saying? He's covering his bases for whatever's possible. I think you need to think that way. Yeah, you know, I really do. I think you need to think that way. And by the way, as a Christian pastor, I'm not afraid of that. Because Christianity has done a lot of bad things in its history. 100% true. But I think if you do the work of objectively breaking apart history and the outcomes, I think you'll still end up with Christianity. You'll still end up with the Bible. You'll still end up with, it makes more logical sense to follow God than not to. So I'm not afraid of you having the whole debate.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the work that you're doing and the intentional care that you've got for those immediately in your life, but also that you're seeking to care for and to pastor as well. So thank you for having a conversation about questions, my friend. Thank you.
Appreciate it. This has been fun.
Ken here. I'm grateful that producer Ben Ford suggested and coordinated this conversation with Mike. A perennial goal of Curated Questions is to identify questions that can be shared and applied across various domains. This conversation with Pastor Mike is an excellent example of the helpful questions he uses within his faith community and can be applied outside of the church walls. As a reminder, the Curated Questions website homepage features a link to record your answers to two questions for potential inclusion in an upcoming episode, as well as an opportunity to sign up for a newsletter, which will be delivered to your inbox every 2 weeks. Here are four key takeaways I've compiled from the episode. Number one, creative boredom as essential practice. Mike emphasizes that leaders must build creative boredom into their lives, unstructured time to think deeply and listen for guidance. His childhood walks along North Carolina creeks, asking endless questions, shaped his entire approach to ministry and life. Modern culture's constant stimulation prevents the deep reflection that produces breakthrough insights. Mike is intentional as he plans his next home to include ponds, creeks, and nature, so his grandchildren can experience the same wonder and questioning that shaped him. The counterintuitive truth, our most productive moments often emerge from our least productive ones. Mike's creative boredom isn't empty time. It's fertile ground where questions can germinate without the pressure to immediately solve or act. Mike's framework forced me to confront my own tendency to fill every moment with stimulation. This recognition led me to embrace my phone-free walks as a non-negotiable creative space. Question: where in your life do you need to create more space for creative boredom? And what might emerge if you stop filling every quiet moment with distraction? Number two, the "Who Do You Say I Am" framework. Throughout major life transitions, such as choosing a ministry, marriage, parenthood, or church leadership, Mike returns to this central question. Rather than accepting external definitions or inherited expectations, he continually examines his identity in relation to God, family, and his calling. This question evolved from childhood insecurity, as "Who am I?" to empowered choice, "Who do I say I am?" demonstrating how the same inquiry can deepen over decades. The shift from "Who am I?" to "Who do I say I am?" represents a move from passive discovery to active authorship of identity. Mike demonstrates that we can choose our narrative rather than simply inherit it. Question: how might shifting from "Who am I?" to "Who do I say I am?" change your approach to major life decisions? Number three, the not-not question and strategic load-shedding principle. Mike transformed from a 150-person pastor to leading a 5,000-plus member network by asking, "What can I not, not do?" This forced identification of his unique contributions, speaking, writing, investing in leaders, and chairing meetings, ensured he focused on where he delivered the most value. Everything else was delegated, allowing him to layer ministry and multiply impact. The question demands brutal honesty about the distinction between irreplaceable and replaceable functions. The double negative construction isn't a grammatical quirk. It is a brain interrupt. It forces us to think about what would collapse without you, revealing the difference between what you think you should do and what only you can do. Question: what would change in your effectiveness if you identified the 3 to 4 things only you can do and systematically handed off everything else? Number four, the grace doctrine tension in leadership. Mike's most emotional moments came when he described his decision to prioritize being a father over defending denominational doctrine as his son had chosen a lifestyle that conflicted with church teachings. His question shifted from, what does doctrine require, to, how does a father show grace? This reflects his evolution from fearing liberal theology to fearing insufficient grace, recognizing that within the Christian tradition, Jesus died for people, not doctrines. Mike's willingness to risk his pastoral position for his parental relationship reveals how the right question can clarify what we truly value when competing loyalties collide. Question: in your leadership roles, where might you be prioritizing institutional expectations over the deeper human needs of those you serve? Now, it's your turn to share what resonated with you. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help and the inspiration on this episode. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. So until next time, keep questioning.